all of my savings were gone. I had nothing to fall back on. I was living, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And I then, shortly after that, actually got that new manager who was awful. I remember one day I came into the office with a long cardigan on, and he looked at me, touched his hands together, and bowed and said, "Is that a kimono?"
Whoa.
For context.
Oh my God.
I'm not Japanese. Still inappropriate, even if I was. When I tell people about these like low moments in my life, it actually is really helpful because people think that they're so alone and making these financial mistakes or like these blunders that wipe them out financially. But to hear someone who is now in a position of stability having made those exact same mistakes, it's actually, I think, refreshing that nobody's perfect. You are going to make financial mistakes. I have made a dozen. And ultimately, it's how do you improve? How do you move on from this? And how do you get out of rock bottom?
Hello, and welcome back to the Rock Bottom Podcast. I'm Ned Fulmer. My guest today is Vivian Tu. Vivian is a former BuzzFeed coworker of mine, and better known as your rich BFF, author of the New York Times best-selling book, Rich AF, and her new book, Well Endowed, hits shelves everywhere February 3rd. Vivian, welcome to the show. You have such a wonderful community of people that you have built, that you've shared really practical, accessible financial tips on how to build their life and build wealth and that money mindset. And I know the journey has not been easy for you, and you've made a lot of sacrifices and tough choices along the way. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation, and I think our audience can get a lot out of everything that you have to say.
Thank you so much for having me. Really excited to reconnect and share this time with you.
Yeah, I feel like the last time we might have been in the same room together, it might have been like eating a seafood tower at a BuzzFeed sales event.
Yeah,
on the company
like
dollar, something like that.
Or more realistically, eating a BuzzFeed catered lunch where the cheese was a mystery cheese. It was cotija, it was feta, it was parmesan, it was whatever cheese it needed to be that day.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Back in the day. I'd like to start at the very beginning. You know, you started as a trader on Wall Street and had a real intense finance background. What drew you to finance, and did there ever feel like there was something more that eventually led you to this creator career?
Yeah, I think I ended up going into finance because I am not a leader. I am a follower. I was in college. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I did know that I wanted to make money and do something that was cool and prestigious, but like not more so than any like idiot 20-year-old. But my junior year, I noticed that like a lot of my colleagues were starting to actually recruit for Wall Street, whether that be investment banking, trading. And I was like, well, you know, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me, I guess. Like that was the cool thing to do. And I was lucky enough to actually be able to get a internship for my junior year summer. And then ended up getting a full-time job offer at JP Morgan to become an equities trader. And I want to tell everyone that there was this mastermind idea to do this and get really rich and become this big financial power player. But like in reality, I wanted to move to a cool city. New York City felt cool. I wanted to have a job that would be impressive to tell people that I did. And frankly, it felt like a really appropriate next step after having gone to the University of Chicago. It's an incredibly competitive school. You know, lots of very, I would say, serious professions come out of it. Lawyers, doctors, engineers, you know, financial people. So it felt like I was doing the responsible thing. And for a while there, it did feel like the right move. I really did believe that I was just going to climb this corporate ladder and I would eventually be happy and do what everybody else is doing.
What changed?
Well, if I'm honest, I had one manager that kind of changed it all for me. When I first started at JP Morgan, I had the most incredible manager. Her name is Jeannie Ma. She is still my mentor to this day. She was at my wedding. We are still close. I see her, you know, every month, every other month. And she took me under her wing. She taught me everything that I needed to know about doing the job, but also what were the cool places to go out at night in New York, and what was the right, like, social thing to be doing during certain times of the year. And she gave me all of those soft skills that I didn't grow up with, because I didn't grow up with money. And she was such a great, like, guardian angel, frankly, of my early 20s. But she couldn't protect me forever. About a year and a half into my career, the head of my desk got let go. And when that happens on Wall Street, there's a whole team shakeup. So he got fired, new guy comes in, fires half the team, brings in his own guys. And all of a sudden, I am looking at a desk that looks very, very different versus the one I agreed to join. I was rotated away from Jeannie, and I got rotated under this new manager. And that was the beginning of the end. I mean, Ned, I could not get one thing right with this guy. Like, he was just like, you're slow, you're stupid, like, didn't like anything about me, didn't like how I wore my makeup, didn't like that my nails click-clacked on the keyboard. And I remember one day I came into the office with a long cardigan on, and he looked at me, touched his hands together, and bowed and said, "Is that a kimono?"
Whoa.
For context.
Oh my God.
I'm not Japanese. Still appropriate, inappropriate, even if I was. And it was one of those moments where I knew this guy was in control of my promotion schedule and whether or not I was getting a bonus at the end of the year. And I felt this lump build in my throat that I couldn't say, fuck you. Can I swear? Sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. That I couldn't say that to that guy. Like, he was my boss. And so I knew that I had to get out of there. And I told my mentor, I was like, I'm leaving, I'm quitting today. And she was like, be so for real. You don't have another job lined up. Go sit back down. We'll talk about this later. And I was like, okay, cool, 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 cool. Good advice, good advice.
Yeah, your first dose of like smart, practical, you know, real yeah. world. Like, hey, maybe don't quit, like, just on a whim.
Yeah, have the other thing lined up. Yep, exactly. Unfortunately, she was correct. Incredibly valid. So I go sit back down. But later that day, I told her what had happened, and I could see the hurt in her eyes that, like, you know, she had cultivated me from being an intern to being her junior to feeling like all of that had been wasted because this man had said something to me that was so deeply inappropriate. And she said, well, what do you want to do? Would you be interested in potentially pivoting industries? I was like, I'll go work retail. I don't care. Like, I'm too smart for this. I'm like, you're not going to talk to me like that. And so I started the interviewing process, but her close friend had formerly worked on Wall Street. Susie Cohen came from Goldman Sachs, ended up in media at BuzzFeed, and she ended up becoming my first manager at BuzzFeed after I went through the interview process. And, you know, I feel so grateful that I got to have a do-over, because I really felt like that was it. Like, my career was going to flounder, and it didn't. It was just a launch pad. It was a beginning.
Right. It was these unexpected shifts along the way. And it seems like being in such a finances typically male-dominated industry, and mm-hmm. here you're having an example of completely inappropriate workplace conversation that's made you leave the job.
Yeah.
It's so bad. And now you're inspiring a community of women and people of color especially. I'm curious how those early experiences shaped your point of view and your desire to build that community and to provide a resource for people that maybe don't typically have it in other avenues.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was not even at the forefront of my mind of like, oh, I want to help underrepresented communities with their money. I was just so lucky that I had like a diverse group of personal friends that were members of the LGBTQ community or people of color or first gen college students. And I thought about my group of friends. And what ultimately ended up happening was when I got to BuzzFeed, all of my new colleagues were like, can you help me with my 401k? Which health insurance plan do I pick? Are company stock options worth anything? LOL.
Turns out I can
make that joke with you. But, you know, and people would say like, oh, you came from Wall Street. Like, of course you're good with your own money. And I'm like, actually, when I was in my early 20s, when I was dating a lot of other people who worked in financial services because it was easier, our schedules aligned, what have you. And I actually went on a date with this one guy who worked in investment banking, was doing billion-dollar deals, and he had five-figure credit card debt. But I saw his apartment. He wore a Rolex, Ferragamo shoes, like Ferragamo tie. I'm like, I'm looking at the credit card debt right now. Like, can you return that
You're
watch?
Wearing it, brother.
You're wearing it, brother. Like, can you return that? Do you still have the tags? And so I realized that if people on Wall Street didn't know their personal finances, and regular people, my girlfriend certainly didn't know their personal finances, then like, who did? So I started helping my colleagues, and so many people started to like form around my desk at lunchtime to ask questions. I was like, no. Like, I'm not about to take on a second unpaid job. So January 1st of 2021, I had made like a fun New Year's resolution of like, oh, I'm going to start this little passion project. It'll be nothing. It'll just be for my friends at work and they'll watch these videos. And turns out more than just my coworkers needed this information, because my very first video ended up going viral. And it was simply me being like, hey, it's the middle of the pandemic. People have no idea what they're doing with their money. There's no such thing as a get rich quick scheme. But if you want to learn, I can teach you. And that was it. But that video ended up getting 3 million views, and I had 100,000 followers by the end of the week.
Wow. That is a TikTok 2021 story if I've ever heard one. That's amazing. 100%. That's amazing. And I know that one thing I love about your work is it's so like connected to like your personality. I mean, you really do feel like someone's best friend talking to them. And I know you do that on purpose, but what, you know, why do you think that is so much more compelling? And what do you think that people need to, you know, take into their own lives when it comes to financial conversations? Because it seems like this topic that's like, oh, can't even
scary.
Talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I have never, ever lied about this. I am not reinventing the wheel. Like, the financial literacy education piece that I actually do, the principles that I'm sharing, they're not new. I didn't invent them, certainly not. But the problem is, the messenger of all of this education over the past couple decades has been a tall, handsome, white man, usually in a Patagonia vest, on CNBC, spouting about, well, you should consider this versus that. And it's like, if you're, and then, you know, you got the opposite side, which is like the older white gentleman who, with like, you know, some sort of evangelical twist, who's like, if you have debt, you're a bad person. I just like, I can't ascribe to being either of those things, unfortunately, because I look like this. But I think what I found and I thought was my weakness looking like this was actually my superpower. For the first time, someone who didn't look like Jim Cramer was talking about money. And I look like I could truly be anybody's college best friend. Like, I am a girl's girl. I am someone who you could tell a secret to, who wouldn't judge you, who would give it to you straight. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. But for once, people thought that they were talking to a peer versus a college professor versus someone who's going to lecture them, or their dad, or their like rich uncle. It really finally felt like you weren't going to be talked down to. You were going to be shared with. And yeah. I think that made all the difference, because the message hasn't changed. The messenger has, though.
Yeah, that's really interesting that there's so much prescriptive kind of paternalistic messaging out there in the financial ecosystem, which surely turns people off. And someone that can be no nonsense and also no judgment, because a lot of the stuff that you might want to know about is like kind of embarrassing. Like, I don't feel great about this, or I need to do better here.
And the crazy thing is like people are so embarrassed to tell me the fact that they have debt. Oh, what are you embarrassed about? Like 50% of people nearly have credit card debt. What do you possibly have to be embarrassed about? If you go into a room of 100 people, half of them are in the same position as you. You're not worse than anybody. You're not better than anybody. These certain financial decisions that you have made, which, by the way, were entirely from a point of a lack of education. We don't teach this K through 12. They don't indicate whether you are a moral failure or not. And I think people forget that. Because money in our society is used as a barometer of success, we've also equated it to a barometer of ethical purity, of if you're debt-free and you're rich, you're a good person. That's not true. And that if you are, you know, in credit card debt and you've had to make some, you've had to take out a payday loan, you're a bad person. That's also not true. I think we need to talk about this plainly, simply, but also recognize that like money is a tool, debt is a tool, all of these things are tools, and it's just your choice what you want to do with them.
Wow. Why do you think that is?
Like the ethical thing?
Yeah.
Because we laud people who have money. Like, think about all of the people that they put on the covers of magazines. They're rich. They're beautiful. They're like, all of these things are like equated into one. Whereas, like, if you thought about actually how some of those people are getting their funds through, frankly, unsavory means or through exploitation of other people, like,
right.
If you knew someone was violating other people's human rights, would you feel like awesome about that? No, but we definitely have put people who are owners of diamond mines and big time jewelers on the covers of magazines. And so I think that like we need to think about why we love to promote and applaud people who have accomplished big things, but we don't talk about the people who actually helped to get them there.
Yeah. You're saying that there should be a alternative heuristic for celebrating humans rather than just money.
Yeah, I do. I also think that like we as a society or as a country, frankly, make a lot of judgments based on success, based on money. So like, oh, like how is the GDP doing? Like, what is the CPI? Like, what are we looking at our inflation numbers? And like, if you look at some other countries, they have like happiness indexes, or like they judge based on the satisfaction of citizens. And I cannot even fathom how much happier we would be as a general populace if that was the case. Like, people don't give a shit about your happiness. They want to know how productive you are and what you are contributing value-wise. And I think that's a little problematic because that means that every single person's only goal is to be efficient and to optimize their life. When in fact, like the greatest moments of my life were when I was doing nothing and spending time with people that I care about and like doing something that couldn't be measured by a bank account and a dollar sign.
Yeah. You know, I think that's so true. And it's a really wonderful template for happiness in life. And, you know, I'd love to continue talking about that and get into some of the more practical applications of it. But before we get there, you know, the show is called Rock Bottom. And I'd like to maybe talk about something that wasn't so happy in your life. Is there anything that comes to mind of a challenging moment that you had to overcome? And how has it informed who you are today?
It's so funny because this is almost like my villain origin story.
Really?
Yeah, it really is. So I moved to New York City after graduation from college to become an equities trader on Wall Street. And I believe my starting salary at the time was $80,000 or $85,000. This was back in 2016. And I was working really hard. I was saving money. Things were going fine. I moved into this apartment and I was so excited because for the first time I was going to have my own room because me and my roommate couldn't afford a two-bedroom apartment when we first got to New York City. So, you know, as I started making more money, as we started having savings, we moved into a two-bedroom apartment down in, you know, the Soho area. And we were like, we're cool girls now. Everything is amazing. And the first weekend after we'd moved in, I was out of town and I got a call from my roommate and I'm like, okay, what's going on? She's like, hey, when you get back, we have to have a conversation. I'm like, about, like, are you mad at me? Like, what's going on? And she's like, nothing like that, but we have to talk. I come back. She tells me, she goes, the first night I was in this apartment, I got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. When I went to the restroom and I flicked on the lights, she goes, Vivian, I saw 1,000 little things scurry away. We had moved into an apartment that, unbeknownst to us, was in a building that was rent, half rent controlled. And because of that, the rent controlled units had not been updated since probably the 60s or 70s. And they were cement flooring. There were no updates made. There were exposed wires, like other units, essentially, because they had been not maintained, became a breeding ground for German cockroaches. And I mentioned the specific species. I got very, very, I have a lot of expertise in this space now. German cockroaches breed twice as quickly as American, or like 10 times as quickly as American cockroaches. So we had an infestation. And we were finding dead cockroaches in our, like, in our clothes, in our bedding. We found one dead in our ice tray.
Oh.
And this was entirely the apartment property manager's fault, but there was nothing we could do. We didn't have the money or time to take them to like a small claims court or anything like that. So we broke our lease and that cost $8,000. And that $8,000 split between me and my roommate wiped out every single dollar I had made from that job that I had saved.
Wow.
And so after having worked for a year, year and a half, I looked at my bank account and I actually had less money than when I had moved to New York City. And I was very much living paycheck to paycheck. But instead of having a normal 40-hour a week job, I was working 70, 80 hours a week. And I felt like I had worked so hard and I had absolutely nothing to show for it except clothes and bedding that I probably wouldn't even be able to take with me. And I was horrified. I took a long, hard look at myself and I was like, what decisions in my life have led me to this moment where I feel like so beaten down? And what can I do to fix this? I ended up moving into a new apartment with my same roommate. We had to keep our stuff in these vacuum sealed bags for like a couple, like there was like a time period that we had to do it. I can't remember if it was like 2 weeks or whatever for, to like ensure that the eggs were all dead or whatever. A lot of gross details here, but ultimately it was the moment where I realized that like I needed to be smarter about my money because one emergency, and albeit a very expensive one, one emergency wiped out my entire savings. And I was lucky I even had that savings. And I felt very lucky that even if I didn't have the savings, I could call my parents and ask for help. So many people in this world do not have those kinds of privileges or luxuries, but it didn't feel good. And it was a real wake-up call for me.
Yeah, the fragility of even if you seem like you have this amazing job, you have this, you know, you're in New York City, then how one catastrophe can completely alter the course of your life.
Yeah.
And it really seemed like you're getting a sense of burnout there. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of like burnout type of descriptions.
Yeah. I mean, like, of course I was burnt out. I was working 70, 80 hours a week and all of my savings were gone. I had nothing to fall back on. I was living, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And I then, shortly after that, actually got that new manager who was awful. And so it just felt like it was hit after hit. I needed a second to just get back up, but it wasn't going to come. So I was going to kind of have to force the issue. And I feel so grateful that I get to call that my rock bottom, and it wasn't some sort of like health diagnosis or like, you know, having like my home burned down. You know, of course, like everyone in the LA fires, like they're really struggling. This was a hard rock bottom to hit at 22 when I had no money and no resources. But ultimately, I feel really grateful that it was, in the grand scheme of things, something that was able to be fixed, something that I could come back from, and it was just going to take time. And it did. It took me a while to get back on my feet and feel like I was financially stable again. But that's kind of all I talk about on my platform, is that like I've been there. When I talk about being paycheck to paycheck, like I have been there, and it's not a fun feeling.
How does that inform your work today?
I think it just makes me more mindful of like, not only does my content have to be helpful, it actually has to be relatable. When I tell people about these like low moments in my life, it actually is really helpful, because people think that they're so alone and making these financial mistakes or like these blunders that wipe them out financially. But to hear someone who is now in a position of stability having made those exact same mistakes, it's actually, I think, refreshing that nobody's perfect. You are going to make financial mistakes. I have made a dozen. And ultimately, it's how do you improve? How do you move on from this? And how do you get out of rock bottom?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, your new book, Well Endowed, is kind of the sequel to Rich AF, where you continue on some of these themes of how to create a positive money mindset, and specifically with some of the big life changes that someone might be going through. You know, what in your experience building the community or writing the book have you seen as the biggest, call them a rock bottom moment, or at least just like financial challenges that people are dealing with? And are there things that people can do to either dig themselves out of a hole or prevent going into it that are really simple and approachable?
Yeah, I think, simply put, Well Endowed talks so much about making a plan for your life, because I think so many of us just venture out and hope for the best. And unfortunately, that's not how the rich do it. For many of us, it's like we plan to work hard, we're going to make money, we're going to save, we're going to do all the right things. But even if you do all of those things, if you do not have your finances fully choreographed, and I'm using that word very specifically, choreographed, you don't know where things are supposed to go, on what beats, at what time, what you should be doing with your arms and legs, like all at once. And I think the important thing to talk about here is, one, knowing what purchases are and are not going to spark joy and actually bring you value. Maybe that's, you know, instead of the new 85-inch flat screen TV, you can actually get something that will serve you longer term, or maybe saving up for larger investments like a car, or buying insurance to protect the things that you love. But also planning your life, like whether that's marriage and divorce, whether that's building a family and setting those tater tots up for financial success, whether that's choosing to get a pet and like knowing that you are going to have to take care of something for the course of its entire life, and even estate planning, like thinking about, how can I have the most enjoyable today possible, but would I like to still leave a little bit of a legacy? Do I want to do something that can help the next generation have it easier than I had it? And I think those are all things that we should really be thinking about.
You've famously pushed it back against the stop buying lattes myth, and I've talked about how people, you know, shouldn't feel guilty about these small challenges. What do you think the antidote to that is? And when it comes to some of these, like, what purchases spark joy? You know, what's the philosophy that people should be taking?
Yeah. So, Ned, I actually did the math, and if you had a $5 latte every single day, at the end of the year, it's roughly like $1,800. Like, where are you buying a home for $1,800? Like, that's a mortgage payment, like, one time. Like, I don't even, and like, for a pretty modest home. So, like, I don't even know what people are talking about. Like, that $1,800 is not the difference maker. However, I do think oftentimes the latte is like a canary in the coal mine for general spending habits. If you are willing to be a dollar dribbler in every facet of your life, that becomes a problem. So what I actually really encourage people to do is the your rich BFF, is it worth it equation. So imagine this. You go out to the store and there's a pair of jeans and you want these pair of jeans and these jeans are $100. What I ask people to do at home is to think about what is their hourly take-home pay. So that's what do you make per hour after taxes? You can do the math of if you have a salary, you need to figure out what you get paid after taxes, divide that across the 52 weeks, divide that across 40 hours a week, whatever, you know, you'll figure out your hourly. Once you have that, instead of calculating $100 for a pair of jeans, how many hours do you have to sit at your desk to afford those jeans? How many hours, say you're a nurse, how many hours do you have to be on your feet with patients to afford those jeans? Say you are a, I don't know, zookeeper. How many hours do you have to spend feeding the giraffes to pay for those jeans? And I think this is so helpful because we as a society do not understand the value of a dollar. And I'm not trying to give you like a lecture like your dad did or whatever, but like we don't understand the value of a dollar because it's not an actual concept. Like something we understand is time. Mm. I know how awesome or how sucky it is to sit at my desk for an hour and do work. I know what I'm willing to trade my time for. And in some cases, I'll look at myself and say, those yoga pants, I probably don't need them since I have four other pairs of black yoga pants. But in other cases, I'm like, you know what? I'm more than happy to spend 2 hours at my desk doing my job for this lovely dinner that me and my husband can enjoy. Or, oh my gosh, like this vacation, I had to work for it for 5 days or 10 days or 15 days, but it was worth it. I'm glad we took this long weekend trip. And so this just helps me visualize what I have to give up to have something in a finite resource being your time.
Yeah, that's really approachable. I haven't heard that before. I think it's really cool. Like there's, you know, yeah, it's a lot more easy to understand the like the suckiness of you know, doing like a work thing that you maybe don't want to do for however long of time that it's going to take. You know, I think that's a lot more interesting and approachable. What do people in your community, how do they resonate with that?
You know, it's so funny the comments that I get about like the little equations and tips that I share. sometimes people will be like, you're being too loud when they agree with me. And they'll say like, you know what? This is the advice I needed to hear, not the advice I wanted to hear. Mm. And I think it's helpful because in the wise words of Paula Pant, you can afford anything, but not everything. And I find that if you are able to budget for something, you can enjoy it twice as much versus, you know, buying something on a whim and not being confident that your credit card's going to go through. So I would just say that, like, my audience is appreciative, though sometimes it's a hard dose of reality when I share these things.
Yeah, it's interesting that idea that, you know, the way that you spend money and the budgeting techniques that you have, like, really kind of can connect to your happiness and your perceived, like, joy, right? Mm-hmm. It's, like, not so much about the money. It's about, hey, have I set myself up with a plan to feel good about spending this money or to feel bad about it?
Can I tell you about the best thing I've ever budgeted for?
Sure.
I feel like people always say that, like, a budget is, like, so boring. They're like, a budget means I can't go out with friends. A budget tells me that I can't do this, I can't do that. A budget very literally tells you, yes, that you can do these things, but you just don't have to do them with fear. I budgeted for an all expenses paid vacation for my parents. They're Chinese immigrants. I'm first gen. I was born here, but you know, I was the first person in my family to go to an American college. I was the first person to be able to really succeed in the traditional sense of the word. And I just felt like my parents had made so many sacrifices and had never really treated themselves. So I sent them on an all expenses paid vacation. I have the photos to prove it. There are multiple photos of my family, like with like tourist signs, and like they're doing like fun little like heart hands, whatever. But that ended up being a multi-$1,000 expense, pretty close to 10 grand. And the only reason I was able to do it is because I budgeted for it. And seeing them go have so much fun while they're still, you know, they're getting older. They're still mobile, but like for them to be able to do that at a point in their lives where they don't have any other responsibilities was a joy for me, but I needed to budget to do it.
Yeah. And making the budget made it that much more joyful because you feel like
exactly
excited and allowed to spend on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned some of the ideas around marriage, divorce, and relationships. I'd love to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
What are some of the uncomfortable conversations that couples need to be having to prepare themselves for success, whether it's a prenup or a marriage or a divorce?
Yeah. You hit the nail on the head. I was just going to say, prenup is my favorite word.
Why is
because
that?
Just because I think that like prenups get such a bad rap. They need to hire a new PR firm. Like, I don't know who's doing prenups PR, but they're doing a bad job. Because everybody thinks a prenup is like, you know, the writing on the wall that you're going to have to get divorced or that you don't trust your partner. But like, whether or not you draft your own prenup, you get one, but the government gets to write it. And I do not care where you fall on the political spectrum, left, right, or center. Your government does not know you and your relationship better than you do. And I'm sure of that. So why wouldn't you want to sit down with your partner on a sunny day and really discuss what is fair, what is just for your relationship? Not only can this be a moment to discuss fully getting financially naked, so there's transparency in the relationship, which is great, a very healthy way to start, because most couples actually don't talk about money until they get engaged, which is diabolical, and we wonder why the divorce rate is so high. But like, we need to have these conversations. Money and sex are the top two reasons why couples fight, and imagine you could eliminate one of those factors. Like, you could just talk about them instead of fighting. Getting that prenup done on a sunny day allows a fair distribution in so many cases. And I want to give you a couple examples. If somebody has a business, making sure that, sure, both parties can benefit from the proceeds of that business, but does the equity go to one specific partner in the case of a divorce? That is the case for my prenup. Your Rich BFF is owned entirely by me. Throughout the course of my marriage, any sort of cash proceeds or earnings are distributed 50-50, but I wouldn't want an ex-partner of mine to have any say in how I run my business if we were to separate. In the case of a stay-at-home parent, a prenup can allow for the stay-at-home parent to financially protect themselves, knowing that they're giving up years in their workforce, years in their career, so that it is fair. I don't want to see some person walk away from a relationship destitute and the other person like a robber baron. That's not the point. The point is truly just to be the one in charge of what goes where. And simply put, it's just an easy way to make everything neat and tidy, because if you have a very long and arduous divorce, neither party wins. The only party that wins is the lawyers.
Well said. What are some of the biggest things that people maybe don't consider to even talk about when they're in a relationship early on and kind of starting to have these conversations?
I think there are different points in each relationship that you should be talking about money. First date being one of them. Listen, I'm not telling you to like show up to your first date and be like, show me your pay stub. Like, don't be a weirdo. But like, ask questions like, if you woke up tomorrow with, you know, enough money for the rest of your lifetime, what job would you have? If it's dramatically different than their current job, that tells you something. Mm. Or if I gave you a 2-week all expenses paid vacation, what would you do? Somebody who wants to go backpacking and climb, you know, Mount Kilimanjaro or the Andes or Mount Everest, that is a very different person than someone who says, oh, I would like to do 2 weeks, the unlimited Disney passes, you know, we're going to go through every single amusement park, is a very different person than someone who says, I'm going to the Maldives and laying on my back for 2 weeks and soaking in the sun and doing nothing. That tells you something about that person. It also tells you about generally some of their spending habits, what they value. But
what's that's the answer for you?
I'm probably closer to the fly and flop. I want to do something where I'm really relaxed. I'm not a hiker. I hate large crowds. So Disney is very hard for me. But yeah, like, you know, I love a beach. I love to have like a strawberry daiquiri in my hand, and some tan lines. So wait, what about you?
New cities, museums, exploring different like cultures, restaurants. I'm would much rather go to like a new interesting city in a country I've never been to and totally just explore and taste everything and, you know, kind of be immersed in something novel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a really good answer. But that also tells you something about you, that you are someone who needs to have activities on a vacation versus someone who wants 2 weeks of nothing.
Yeah, at the Maldives, you could find me on the pickleball court.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'd be like, all right, I'm ready to leave the beach.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then I think, you know, another big conversation comes when you go exclusive, because at a certain point, it's no longer about chivalry or not or what have you. It's like, how do we fairly split relationship expenses? Another big moment is when you move in together. The vast majority of couples live together before they actually tie the knot these days, as some members of my family call it, living in sin, whatever. But that's fine. but you know, like when you are having a legal document binding you and someone else that you are both on the hook for probably the largest expense in your life, your housing, you got to have some conversations. What is your credit score? Are we going to be approved for this apartment? What do you want to spend on furniture? Should we be Craigslisting stuff, or are we going to go to West Elm and get stuff like and buy stuff? Like, these are all big conversations. And then as you're starting to think about really spending the rest of your life together, I think there are a lot of emotional conversations that people don't realize have dollar signs attached to them. So
really,
if you want to have children, how many are we putting them in, public or private school? What is the plan for their extracurriculars? What neighborhood do we particularly maybe want to move into so they can get into a better public school district? These are all dollar sign questions. As our parents age, how are we taking care of them? That may become a financial burden that falls on you or your partner. The average like assisted living facility is thousands of dollars all the way to up to probably $15,000 a month in some Whoa. Major cities. So like, you better have that conversation now. I also think like a lot of these conversations can prepare you for some of the estate planning that you might want to do, of like, knock on wood, heaven forbid, one of us gets into some sort of car accident. Do we want to be put on life support? Do we want a resuscitation order? Do we want, certain limbs to be amputated if it comes to that? Like, these are conversations you want to have now, because not only are they deeply emotional conversations, but do you know what it costs to stay in a hospital? It's a lot of money. Do you know what it costs to have PT, it's a lot of money. And so all of these things, I think, are really, really good to have early on. The sooner you can, the better. They don't need to be hardcore conversations. This can be done easily over a delivery pizza and a bottle of wine. Make it fun. Make it just as important as talking about what color you're going to paint the nursery. You're frankly probably doing your relationship a bigger service by doing this now.
Yeah, it seems like a good theme of your advice is not only is it really practical, but it also kind of creates like a bubble or a container for someone to just live their best life.
Live their best life, but you know that like financial health is one of the largest factors impacting mental health these days. Mm-hmm. If you actually think about, like, totally makes sense, right? Someone who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from, someone who doesn't know whether or not they can continue to afford their rent, someone who might be having their car repossessed is obviously going to be more stressed out and more anxious and more prone to feeling high levels of emotional stress than someone who has all of those basic needs met and then can just deal with the upper level stuff of like, maybe my job is stressful, or maybe I'm having some issues in my personal life with relationships with friends or family. But like, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If you do not get the baseline stuff done, you're going to feel more stress.
It completely overwhelms every aspect of your life, and it is completely paralyzing in a way. Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. From, you know, what would you say to someone that is really struggling?
Yeah. I think it's first and foremost addressing those struggles head on. I know it might feel better to stick your head in the sand for a little bit, but you're just going to have more problems, and they might even snowball to become bigger problems later on. So I think first addressing stuff. Two, making a timeline. I'm not talking about making just like I want to do that. Like, tell me when you're going to do it by. Like, you need to make sure that your goals are all really, really time bound. That way there's a deadline. And then three, I would say knowing when to ask for help and where to find those resources. Listen, I think that we could all be a little bit better off if we got smarter and more efficient at asking for help. Back in our parents' generation, our parents had to do this a lot more because there were no on-demand services. Like, your parents would call the neighbors and be like, hey, we're out of town for a week. Can you come feed, you know, Snowball? And your neighbors would come over and feed your cat and maybe walk the dog or water the plants. And then the next time your neighbors needed to get dropped off at the airport with their four bags, they would say, hey, can you drive us? I'm so sorry. It's like really early. The flight's at 7 a.m. But your parents would grit their teeth, wake up at 5 and drive them to the airport. But because of that, we had this muscle memory of being able to ask for help. And it didn't ever feel like it was overtaking. Whereas now it's like, oh, you hear people say this. They're like, oh, sorry, I don't have bandwidth for this right now. I have to protect my peace. They use like this like weaponized therapy speak. Mm-hmm. When in fact, you're just being a crappy friend. And over time, a lot of us have said, instead of friends, we'll just have corporations. There is now a robot car that can drive me to the airport. Not even just like a stranger, but like a robot car with no driver can take me to the airport. Or if I'm feeling sick, instead of the neighbor making me a chicken pot pie, I can just order one online and it can be delivered to me in 30 minutes or less. Like, we've taken the human connection out of life. And that's really unfortunate, because when we are struggling, it may feel counterintuitive, but the thing that's going to make you feel better, is to actually tell somebody and ask for help. And I truly think that those are the three things that'll kind of get you on your way and get started. And once the ball does start rolling, it gets easier, because the hardest part is always starting. And I feel that way about the gym, eating right. The first 2 weeks are brutal. But once you kind of get into a routine and you're like feeling good, like, you can just keep doing it.
And oftentimes people are happy to help. They're
happy.
You're kind of like giving them a gift of being able to help you. Yeah, it's interesting that some of this advice that you're talking about is not so much about the dollars and cents or exactly the numbers. It's really like some more holistic and like soft skill building to kind of help people just feel better about their overall picture.
The actual financials are very cut and dry. Like math is math is math. Like you should be saving 3 to 6 months of living expenses. You should be paying down your high interest rate debt. You should be saving for retirement. And by that, I mean investing for retirement. You can get a robo-advisor if you don't know what to invest in. You want to make a plan. But like, that's the easy part. Mm-hmm. Once you actually have your roadmap of things you need to do, getting it all automated isn't that hard. The really hard part is like getting people to want to change. And if they don't want to change, they're not going to get there.
So describe to us, what is a well-endowed life? Like when it's all kind of clicking and you're just sitting back at the end of life being like, dang, we did it, Joe. We have a well-endowed life. You know, what is it? What do you think it feels like and looks like?
Yeah. Well, I think a well-endowed life looks different for everyone. But I think we need to like step back and actually talk about the phrase well-endowed. Yes, I made the title of the book a dick joke. But if you actually think about the phrase well-endowed, what does it refer to? It's talking about an endowment. And you've probably heard this phrase used in regards to universities having endowments for students, or maybe a big time donor gave a bunch of money to your favorite philanthropy. And so they have an endowment. An endowment is simply a pot of money that allows an organization to further its mission, further its goals into perpetuity for the rest of time, continue on and on and on. And that's what I truly think it means to be well endowed in your life. It just means that you actually have the resources and facilities to be able to buy the things that are going to give you joy in your life, that are going to protect your family, that are going to help you have a healthy relationship. And I don't just mean like a romantic one, but like one with friends, one with family, setting healthy boundaries, but also making sure that you have what you need to have those conversations. And then also being able to leave something behind. I hope for my version of being well endowed at the end of my life on a breezy fall day, I hope to be sitting on my swing set in my backyard, looking around as I have multiple grandkids running around the backyard, jumping into, you know, a pile of leaves. And I have kids who love me and are willing to continue to help out as Nana's getting older. And I truly hope that like all of the things that matter most to me have longevity. And turns out none of those are things at all. They're mostly people or intangibles or knowing that I can sleep soundly at night.
Yeah. That's a beautiful vision.
Yeah.
Vivian, one final question. What's something you would say to your younger self?
Ooh. Man.
Maybe that self that has just found out about the infestation and the bills and checked her account, that is meaning all of her hard work has been reduced to zero.
This is going to be so cliche, Ned. I like don't even want to say this out loud.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Yeah.
No, I think the real cliche is that like time heals most things. And if time can't heal it, you'll heal it yourself. So I think like at every point in my life where I felt like, wow, this is so terrible, everything is so bad, I can then find a point, maybe it's weeks, maybe it's months, maybe it's years after, that I'm like, okay, I can't believe I got out of that position. And more often than not, time made it a lot better. But I also think that we each need to take accountability and agency and do the things that'll help get us there. So time heals all wounds. Time heals all things. And if time can't heal it, you got to heal it yourself.
That's right. And it's about patience, right? It's about like continuing on a path, knowing that if you keep working at it, it'll change. And yeah, I love that. Time heals all wounds. And if you can't heal it yourself.
Exactly.
Well, Vivian, thank you so much. Your new book, Well Endowed, is out everywhere February 3rd. Everyone check it out. Great chatting with you.
Thank you so much. You can find me everywhere as Your Rich BFF, and you can grab the book at richbffbook.com. Thank you so much for having me.